Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Kirk Migu, host of Politics and Polemics on the New Books Network. I also host my own podcast called Independent Thought and Freedom, where I interview some of the most interesting people from around the world who are shaking up politics, economics, society, and ideas. You can find it in the iTunes Store or on any one of your favorite podcast providers. You can also subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, are you an academic that wants to get heard nationally? Check out my free training on 3 steps how to use your intellectual authority to become a media personality at becomeapublicintellectual.com. That's becomeapublicintellectual.com. You can find the links below. And now, on to this week's episode. Hello. Today my guest is Mark Sedgwick, author of Key Thinkers of the Radical Right, Behind the New Threat to Liberal Democracy. Mark Sedgwick is a British historian specializing in the study of traditionalism, Islam, Sufi mysticism, and terrorism. He's professor of Arab and Islamic studies at Aarhus University in Denmark and chair of the Nordic Society for Middle Eastern Studies. He was formerly secretary of the European Society for the Study of Western Esotericism. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Yes, yes, it's a pleasure. I look forward to a really interesting discussion. Not only this book, which I think is very important, but really your whole body of work is fascinating, and the line of inquiry that you've been pursuing over many, many years. But could you just, I gave a little introduction just now, but could you please tell us a little bit more about yourself and sort of what got you interested in this subject?
Yeah. And also, I mean, people may be wondering why a professor of Arab and Islamic studies is working on the radical right, which is not really the same subject. The fact of the matter is I'm a historian by training, and I started off working on the history of Sufism. And during my PhD, I was really looking at a Sufi order that started off in the Hejaz, in the Arabian Peninsula, and then moved out through Southeast Asia. But as I was working on this, I heard about a branch of a Sufi order in Milan. And I thought this was this same order that I was working on. In fact, I thought this was so interesting that Cairo. I was living in Cairo. It's not too far from Milan, direct flight. So I just went and had a look in Milan. And there I met the guy who was running this tariqa, this Sufi order, who was an Italian who started talking to me about René Guénon, the great traditionalist author. and also told me about how he himself had got into this whole subject of traditionalism, which was through meeting Julius Evola, who is also one of the leading traditionalist authors. So through this, when I was trying to study a Sufi order, I got into this whole world of Evola and traditionalism and so on, which I found so interesting that I've been working on it ever since.
Right. So it's kind of an accidental discovery when working in one field, and you made this connection, this esoteric connection. Yeah.
I mean, plus it is actually still connected to my sort of main Islamic field, because there are these overlaps. I discovered afterwards it wasn't just this one order in Milan. There are multiple overlaps between Islam today, which is a global phenomenon, and what's happening in the esoteric world, and also in these political worlds.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if we start off from your current book that we'll be focusing on in this particular interview, Key Thinkers of the Radical Right, I suppose we should perhaps, like, you know, good academics, start off with a definition. What is the radical right? And, you know, why is it important? You know, people have been hearing about, you know, the alt-right and, you know, Donald Trump, Brexit, you know, how does that all fit into it?
Yeah, well, I mean, in a sense, the radical right and the alt-right are almost the same thing. The term alt-right tends to be used more in the North American context, and the radical right is an American, a European, and now, quite interestingly, also a South American and Russian phenomenon. So the alt-right could be understood as the North American section of this larger phenomenon of the radical right. Radical in the sense that they are criticizing the whole system. There's one understanding of radical which refers to the origin of the term, referring to a root, right? That radicals are people who are looking at the roots of the system and critiquing the roots of the system rather than looking at the way the system is operating, rather than looking at the uses or the abuses of the system. So that's the sense in which they're radical. The sense in which they're right is less easy. I mean, sometimes they describe themselves as right, but sometimes they don't. And quite where the right is and what the right means is actually one of the things that some of them are questioning, because we used to have this neat left-right division, which in many countries' politics you could point to a nice big center-right party and a nice big center-left party, and they disagreed on certain economic questions, on certain social questions, and that was all nice and easy to understand. That system is falling apart everywhere in national politics, and these radical right people are challenging that system as well. So some of them will actually say, we are neither right nor left. We're a third force or a fourth force. So placing them on the right is less clearly correct than calling them radical. But at least they're certainly not left, and they're certainly not center. So if we're operating with that sort of a system, we have to put them on the right. The importance of these people nowadays, I mean, you mentioned Donald Trump, you mentioned Brexit, is increasing, I think, precisely because of the way that politics everywhere is changing, that the old center parties are losing their support and that new parties are coming in. Now, this is something that's happening for many, many reasons, and the ideologies of the radical right are not themselves driving this process, I think, but they are certainly benefiting from this process, and they may be contributing to this process. These guys we're talking about in today and that are in this book on the key things for the radical right, they are mostly quite serious intellectuals. And Donald Trump does not, as far as I know, read difficult, serious intellectuals. I don't know how many people who were behind UKIP and Brexit are reading these serious intellectuals. But there are people who are close to some of these figures who are reading these. And of course, in the United States, the most famous person in this respect was Trump's former advisor, Steve Bannon. Bannon, we know, has been reading these guys and is inspired by them. And I think there are other people out there like Bannon, not themselves the front rank politicians, but people who are working with or behind the front rank politicians who are reading these thinkers.
Yeah, it's almost like George W. Bush surely never read Leo Strauss, but he was surrounded by people who did.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I mean, I think to have a president who spent his or her time reading difficult theoretical texts would be a bit worrying. I don't think that's what an elected leader is really meant to do, but their staff should.
Right. And, you know, you talked about the falling away of the sort of old right and left distinction, which now that I'm looking back on things, I wonder if it was ever adequate, but certainly now it's exposed for being inadequate. And especially for a lot of listeners who are mainly in America, although we do have listeners from all over the world, but in the United States, the right, what is considered conservative, is sort of capitalists, you know, and I don't know, corporatists and big business, but that's not what the radical right is at all. In fact, I remember when I first came across just European conservatism, I was pleasantly surprised and also shocked that there's a whole anti-capitalist tradition on the right that, you know, is hardly even understood in the United States. And this is the kind of right wing that, this is a tradition that the right you're talking about sort of fits in. Am I correct?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct. I mean, in fact, in Europe as well as in the United States, the center-right parties tend to identify with business interests and so forth. But these key thinkers of the radical right are not particularly interested in business. And in fact, they do tend to be quite critical of the capitalist system, of finance. And one of the things that they're all most critical of is what they call global elites. And they tend to identify the global liberalism that they are critiquing with the global capitalism. And several of them are arguing that the global elites and global capitalism and global liberalism is just a front for the financial interests of international finance. So at that point, one's beginning to hear things that one would probably expect to be hearing not from the right, but from the left.
That's right. I mean, in fact, I came to understand these thinkers myself through the left and through the radical left. Like for instance, when you read Marx, his criticism, well, one of the things he praises capitalism for is for undermining traditional society, right? And then socialism is supposed to be after that, and communism after that. But the traditionalist right, or the reactionary right, or is is at one with Marx on that, that capitalism does destroy traditional society, you know, hierarchy, religion, tradition, belief, etc., monarchy. And so they are critical of capitalism for the same reasons in that sense. And at one point in my own reading and thinking, through anarchist literature, through people like, I can't remember his name, but Revolutionary Violence from France, George Sorel, and these type of people who are considered on the left, they had a lot of affinity with the right. So it's kind of like the anti-liberal left had a lot in common with this radical right in the critique of global capitalism. And there's this way that the radical right and the radical left in their critique of liberalism is very similar. Would you agree?
No, I would completely. I mean, in fact, there have been a couple of occasions on which, at least a couple of occasions, there are two occasions that I know of, when people on the far right have actually got into contact with people on the far left and said, look, you know, basically, we should be fighting together. Neither of these occasions really led to anything, but the fact that the conversation could even start illustrates very nicely what you've been saying, and also illustrates one of the problems with using this left-right division, because at a certain point they actually come together. I mean, something I should add, though, is that I think, although the radical right, like the Marxists, see capitalism as destroying tradition and religion, whereas for Marxists, this is a good and useful destruction that paves the way to a desirable future. For nearly everybody on the radical right, this is an undesirable and unfortunate destruction. So they agree about the process, but they disagree about whether this process is or is not desirable.
Yeah, and to move back toward your book, I mean, you did mention in the book that two of the thinkers that you were not going to cover, because they're covered so widely elsewhere, are Nietzsche and Heidegger, and that's very important because both the right and left, admire these thinkers, or at least elements of the right and elements of the left admire these thinkers. So I suppose with that, could you give us, so now that we understand what we're talking about in this radical right, that it's not just a typical sort of capitalist big business at all, it's something else. Could you give us a sense of the evolution of the radical right thinking, you know, some of the key thinkers, how they're similar to each other, how they're different?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that for this, it's useful to go back to the French Revolution. My book doesn't go back to the French Revolution, but if one wants to understand this, one way of conceiving of it is in terms of the French Revolution and reactions to the French Revolution and the struggles that go on throughout the 19th century, which are in some ways just a continuation of the French Revolution. And if in the 19th century one can think of things in terms of a sort of liberal republican side struggling against a church and crown side, the church and crown side is in some ways the beginnings of this phenomenon. That was then, and the First World War changes things, or alternatively certain things are happening around that time, like the transformation of society by industrialization, the creation of mass society, whatever. Certain things that are happening around the time of the First World War and or the First World War itself changes things so much that old 19th century right of church and crown ceases to be relevant, and there are a few survivals here and there, but basically it just withers away and disappears. So the today's radical right starts immediately after the First World War as part of that which replaces the old 19th century church and crown right. And after the First World War, we have coming into being two groups or two types of radical right movement. One of those groups is what we nowadays call fascism, historical fascism, the Italian fascists, the Nazi Party, and so on. They were part of what happened because of the things that had happened in the First World War, because of the way that society was changing. But the Nazis and the Italian fascists were not the only guys around. They were the big guys. They were the guys who succeeded, and they were the guys who then made an appalling mess of things. And you know, in the case of the Nazis, words begin to fail to describe how badly they did in the end. Mm-hmm. That is one of the reasons why, after the Second World War, that first type of post-World War I right has really become as irrelevant as the church and crown people had become after the First World War, because you know, nobody in their right mind wants to recreate the Holocaust. And anything which is in any way touched by that, these appalling events, nobody in their right mind wants to have anything to do with. So what happens then is it's the second category of interwar thinkers who were not Nazis and were not fascists and who were the less important guys at the time. But after the Nazis and the fascists have been removed from the picture, these early guys, interwar guys, suddenly assume a new importance. And this is people like Julius Evola, whose name has already come up. These are the people who are really the basis of today's liberal right. So that's the first phase, I beg your pardon, who are the basis of today's radical right. That's been the first phase of the history of the radical right. We've got a second phase in the 1960s,
70s. Can I just ask you one thing here? So where does Oswald Spengler and the decline of the West fit into what you've described so far?
Yeah, well, I mean, Spengler's actually writing during the First World War. He's read immediately in the aftermath of the First World War. So his idea of the decline of the West is one of the fundamental ideas of the radical right. In some ways, of course, it's not actually what he was saying. And if you read The Decline of the West, you discover that he is considering a future in which the West will have had its time, because he sees civilizations as rising and falling and so on. But the way that's understood by many people is by saying, you know, First World War, oh my dear, oh my goodness, oh dear, the West is now in decline. And that's one of the fundamental ideas behind the radical right.
And he certainly is one of the most widely read persons that can be considered, part of, I don't know if you want to call it the canon of the radical right, but you know, a lot of people would be familiar with his work, if not Evola or anybody else, but they would know Spengler.
I mean, of course, somebody else from that period who's quite widely read, I think, is Carl Schmitt.
Yes,
and yeah, I mean, you know, there are people on the left as well who are reading Carl Schmitt. I mean, Carl Schmitt is a much more difficult author in many ways. He's got a much, much more complex ideas, a much more complex work. But he's quite widely read as well. Julius Evola is a bit of a specialist taste, And the other one who I think is one of the great classic thinkers here is Ernst Jünger, who I think is less widely read, certainly outside Germany. But I mean, coming back to the question of the evolution, that's, you know, that's our interwar period, and then we have a new phase, as I was saying, in the 60s and 70s. The 60s one thinks of as the period in which all sorts of leftist ideas were being more and more widely received. But at the same time as those leftist ideas were doing very, very well in the public sphere, there was also alternative or even perhaps counter ideas on the right, which were not getting anywhere very much in the 60s and 70s, but which are getting somewhere now. And this
Continue,
yeah,
sorry.
This is the point where a name like Alain de Benoist becomes so important. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, no, because I think one of the interesting points, I like to look at the interface between the left and right. The new left in the 1960s were embracing things like spirituality, religion, non-Western, well, Sufism, right? And Hinduism, Buddhism, these sorts of things, which very often would bring them into contact with these traditionalists and esotericists who would be on the right. And I think that there's an interesting connection there as well. Would you say that would be an important part of the story here of the development of the radical right?
I think it's certainly a very interesting development, and you're absolutely right that when one looks at this period, one's got leftist Sufis and rightist Sufis, and I'm not sure how much contact there is between them. There is contact because, you know, on the one hand, they're leftists or rightists, but on the other hand, you know, they're all Sufis, so they have a certain space in which they can talk to each other. Another way, of course, in which the left and right of this period have got something in common is that both of them are depending on Gramsci, who, you know, he was writing for the left, but his ideas about what produces political transformation were read by the new right, and really important to the new right. So they disagreed with his objectives, but they certainly agreed with his analysis of how change happens.
Yeah, certainly Andrew Breitbart is like a Gramscian when he talks about the politics is downstream from culture. That's Gramscian. And I mean, I was even thinking of things like Savitri Devi, the deep ecology movement, vegetarianism. These sorts of things that really, and the whole critique of modern society as being spiritually empty, right? That is so much part of the right, of the radical right, that I think people who have a cartoon view of what the radical right view is don't understand the radical right's profound critiques of the emptiness of modern society, and which brings them, and I think that was, part of, the sort of existentialist left, let's say with George Sorel and things like that in France, where they would have this sort of common ground, and I've never heard of the radical right really being influenced by Kierkegaard and stuff like that. But I do see parallels. I don't know if you've ever come across anything like that.
I haven't come across that. But I think earlier on you were pointing to the question of the relationship between politics and esotericism, which is a question which worries quite a lot of my colleagues in contemporary study of esotericism, because they're all nice liberal people, and they are a bit worried about the way that esotericism tends to get associated with the right. Now, of course, esotericism tends to get associated with the right today. Yeah. But if you go back to the 1880s, it wasn't associated with the right, it was associated with the left.
And so, anti-colonialism, etc., yeah.
And exactly, anti-colonialism, women's rights, animal rights, you know, all these causes, all these classic causes of vegetarianism, as you said. So, I mean, if one asks oneself, well, what on earth is going on here? Now, which is it? The answer is probably precisely this question of critique, that there's an overlap between people who do a radical critique of existing society and people who are interested in esotericism. And in a sense, you know, you start off with a radical critique, and then you might go left, or you might go right, or you might go left and then right, or you might go right and then left. I'm not sure how many people go right and then left. But in a sense, it's the critique which is central.
Going through your survey of the thinkers, so we went through the World War One period and the post-World War One, and World War Two with Evola becoming important. And then in the 60s and 70s, I think we kind of stopped there. You were talking about Benoit. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I think Alain de Benoit is probably the biggest name of the sort of the post-war 60s period. And then, I mean, after that, we then move into the contemporary period. And it's a bit more difficult to say what's going on in the contemporary period. Firstly, because it's always more difficult to say what's going on in the contemporary period, which is one of the reasons why I trained as a historian, because, you know, in the past it stopped moving. So you can see what actually happened. But it's more difficult partly because it is the contemporary period, as I was saying. It's also more difficult because there's now so much more going on. And this is partly because new ideas on the right seem to be benefiting from the change in politics. It's partly because of developments like the growth of the internet. But for whatever reason, there's a lot more going on today, which makes it more difficult to say, you know, exactly what is going on. And it's fairly easy to pick out the name of Alain de Benoit, and it's fairly easy to pick out the name of Evola. But to pick out the name of younger people, the new generation today, people who are in their 30s and 40s, and say, you know, here is the key thinker of the current age, that can't really be done.
Yeah. You have a lot of. I mean, your list of thinkers here. If you have Guillaume Fay and Archaeofuturism, Paul Gottfried, and paleoconservatism, Pat Buchanan. Well, he's someone widely known and read, particularly in the United States. Jared Taylor, Alexander Dugan, Bat Yor. So these are I suppose the I guess the 80s and 90s thinkers. Would you put them?
Yeah. And I mean, some of them, you know, you. As you say, Pat Buchanan is fairly widely known. Alexander Dugin is increasingly widely read. Bat Yeor is less widely read, but she represents a stream of ideas which has been quite influential in recent years.
Now, of these thinkers, I guess we could say both modern and past. Maybe we could divide it into two sections. One that are around today, like, you know, even Richard Spencer or Greg Johnson or these people. Who do you think are the most serious and substantial?
Well, I mean, the classic thing, because I think it has to be Carl Schmitt. You know, Carl Schmitt is a major philosopher. He's not quite up there with Heidegger, but, you know, he's moving in that direction. You know, you could see this by the all the different people who have used him and used him for different purposes. So I think he's, you know, in this book, he's probably the outstanding thinker. For the modern period, for the post-war period, I would pick out Alain de Benoist as the most substantial thinker, because he and the group around him, you know, over many, many, many years, many, many, many people have been writing articles and books, and there is a really substantial intellectual production there. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I mentioned Batillon, and you know, as a scholar, I shouldn't sound too judgmental, but frankly, Batillon is in no way serious and in no way substantial.
Yeah,
but she's incredibly influential at the same time.
Right, right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And just to be clear, Alain de Benoist is still active and he's still around.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's past the peak of his productive years now, but he's still around and still important.
Yeah, and Alexander Dugin is notable for his actual influence on modern government policy in Russia, at least I would say.
Well, I mean, I'm not so sure about his impact on Russian policy. I mean, there have been a number of articles in the Western media calling him, you know, Putin's Rasputin, or on one occasion, Putin's brain. Yeah. Not really. We don't know what exactly is going on in the Kremlin. Is not terribly transparent, but there are certain people who are clearly pretty close to Putin, and he isn't. The thing is that what he is saying fits quite neatly with Russian policy in recent years.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean to say that Russian policy is dictated by Alexander Dugin.
Right. He's sort of outlining the broad outlines, I suppose, and general direction and sort of objective forces that are pushing policy in certain directions.
Yeah, I mean, he's producing analyses that fit quite well with other people's analyses and fit quite well with actual events.
Yeah. Now, in terms of this book, your list of thinkers, and it, just to be clear for the readers, it's an edited collection, so it's many authors speaking about, writing articles on these various thinkers. The point you're making, as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's not that you are, you know, endorsing the right at all, because I believe most of these, if not every one of the people who are writing about these thinkers, are critical of them. But it's to tell centrists or people who may not have considered these people, or others who just marginalize them and don't even bother to look at them. I think what you're trying to do is say, listen, these people have serious ideas that some people take seriously, and it's not because they're stupid. There is something here that you should understand if you want to argue against them effectively. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's something if you there's something that people need to understand if they want to understand what's going on in the world at present.
Yeah.
But you know, there is a tendency for people to think of the right in terms of football hooligans, and you know, I mean, football hooligans are probably on the right, yes, but I mean, you know, there's an awful lot more to it than that. And if you think that the right is just about football hooligans, you're not going to be able to understand what's going on. And I think it's important to understand what's going on.
Yeah. So what would you say some of the most, I don't know how to describe it, seductive, attractive ideas are that may pull intelligent people, you know, to that camp, and if, you know, if somebody, you know, wants to understand what it is, what it is that is the draw for, you know, you for thinking people, and sometimes sensitive people who move, you know, in those circles. What would you say some of these ideas are? Because I think, as you say, a lot of people just say, oh, these are football hooligans, they're racist, they're Nazis, they're skinheads, they, you know, they're just brutes, basically. But what you're definitely showing here is that these aren't brutes, this is something else.
Yeah. I mean, I think that for some intelligent people, it's the very radicalness of the critique that can be appealing. Because, you know, it's almost, you could almost call it fearless, except that sounds a bit too much like an endorsement. I mean, one can do stupid things fearlessly, right? Fearless doesn't have to be an endorsement, but it can, you know, it can be very attractive. I think that for people in general, one of the ideas which is very attractive is the critique of the global cosmopolitan elite. Because,
right,
you know, one can see that this is a growing feeling, something that was very visible with Brexit. And I think it's somewhat visible in the Trump universe as well. Another idea is that's quite powerful is the way that people are talking about, you know, the decline of the West, or the threat of decline. You know, human beings are hardwired to be worried about decline and the apocalypse and stuff. So if you give form to those ideas, and if you're talking about those ideas, the decline of Western culture, the decline of Western manhood, the decline of Western civilization, in various ways, that is going to tend to find an audience.
Yeah, I mean, when I sort of first came across them and understood them to, you know, be serious and to be taken seriously, it was one of the things, I think, was through Camille Paglia's, when she sort of introduced me to the idea of 19th century romanticism, and the decadent movement. And so, like, a lot of these artists and poets and people who I like, and most people, you know, might generally like, many people, and who would not consider themselves on the right in any way, you know, they have this critique of rationality, a critique of capitalism because of its sort of radical rationality. And you know, I never understood anti-Semitism and you know, why it was such a big thing in Europe. And then when I started to read, like, people like Herder and some passages of Nietzsche, and, you know, you talk about the global cosmopolitan elite, this idea of rootlessness, of not being attached to a place and having these sort of deep bonds of tradition and community, I started to understand what the intellectual argument around it was, and that it wasn't just merely some sort of unexplainable disease, that there was a some sort of substance that they were pushing there. Do you see that link with the contemporary criticism of the global cosmopolitan elite back to that sort of 19th century European romanticism?
I think this is definitely right. There's this sort of competition between rootlessness and rootedness, mm-hmm. and the right is always in favor of the rootedness, and today's right is in favor of rootedness, rooted in cultures, rooted in civilizations, not so much rooted in particular soils. Not so much blood and soil, but certainly in cultures and peoples, and in myth as well, in pagan myth sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what I found and what I find interesting is this radical right critique of the mainstream right, because the mainstream right that is considered capitalist. And let's say the neoliberals, the free marketeers, the neoconservatives, these radical right people are very critical of them. And because capitalism, in a sense, promotes rootlessness. It, you move to wherever the job is. You're not really supposed to be the kind of liberal, individual, rational thinker, which is part of, what many people consider as, fundamental right-wing politics. These radical right thinkers are totally against that. Indeed. And I find that fascinating. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I mean, I think you're quite right. It's in some ways problematic to use the term right for two groups of people who have such different views on such important questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to get to the subtitle of your collection here. Which is that behind the new threat to liberal democracy. Mm. What sort of threats do these people pose? Do you think, because the big thing about people talk about Trump is that it's fat, he's going to bring back fascism, or people like Bolsonaro, I don't know if he would be really considered the radical right in that sense, but certainly Trump, they talk about fascism, and they talk about the new right parties in Europe, definitely with their sometimes have explicit links in the past with fascist movements or even the present. Is that the type of threat to liberal democracy you're talking about, or is it even something else?
I mean, I don't think that the return of fascism as it existed in that period is a particular risk. And I'm stressing as it existed in that particular period. If you look at some of the first enthusiasts of Evola's work in Italy in the 50s and early 60s, some of them were people who had been important in the fascist party. But that was then. The world has changed. These guys, they're all dead, and the world has completely changed. So history, no way is history going to repeat itself in that fashion. But we've got people, you mentioned Trump, you mentioned Bolsonaro, there are others. There are others in other countries, and there are others to come, I'm sure, who are certainly rejecting the whole idea of liberal democracy. Bolsonaro, it's a bit like Trump, because there is Bolsonaro's favorite intellectual who is a guy called Olavo de Carvalho, who is not actually in this book because he's not much read outside Brazil. And one of the criteria for being included in this book was that you had to have a significant international audience, which Olavo, as everybody calls him, does not. Olavo's background is, however, very much in this world. I mean, he was for many important years very close to the traditionalist group that Evola is part of, although he was closer to Guénon than to Evola, or to the writings of Guénon and Evola. And I mean, okay, he's moved on since then, but I think these ideas are still quite important to him. So Bolsonaro is another example of this. I mean, okay, why is it a threat? I think there's the short-term threat and there's the long-term threat. And if one wants to look at the short-term threat, is very, very well represented by people like Anders Behring Kleivik in Norway and the Australian Brenton Tarrant in New Zealand. And that's quite a large number of dead people in both of these cases. And in these two cases, while Breivik was directly inspired by Batia Orr and refers quite a lot to her theories, and Tarrant was inspired not by Batia or so much as by Renaud Camus, who is somebody who, if I was going to do a second edition of this book, I think we might need a chapter on Camus and his great replacement theory. So there's an immediate threat there. In the longer term, I think that the liberal democratic order has been based on certain ideas and certain understandings that people of my generation, especially who grew up in the West with these ideas, took them as unquestionable truth. Mm-hmm. And these ideas are now being challenged in a very fundamental fashion by these people. And the challenge is there, not just because of intellectual reasons. The challenge is there also because the world is changing. The world that I grew up in the 60s, 70s, whatever, it has changed. So it's the way in which these key thinkers are questioning some of the very ideas that we took as beyond question, ideas that are very, very fundamental to the liberal democratic order, that is the biggest threat to that order.
Yeah. This question I'd like to ask you ties into my personal position being, from, let's say, the third world or in the Caribbean and with Indian roots, ancestry, meaning from South Asia as opposed to Native American, and the whole movement of third world nationalism and that critique. We've had a critique in the third world of liberal democracy and the liberal world order as being exploitative. And, it's generally being considered on the left. But, you yourself you got into this, as you were mentioning, through the study of Sufism. Oh. Right? So you have these critiques coming from the third world of liberal democracy, of the liberal world order. And then within the West, too. You have, the left, who are also there are elements of the left that are critical of this new world order. How do you see Well, I guess let's take it from the sort of non-Western critiques of liberal democracy. How do you see any interface between, like for instance, the rise of China in trying to remake, even institutions like moving away from the IMF and World Bank and having this Belt and Road Initiative instead, that the whole world order, it's not only an internal political battle within Western countries, but even between third world or developing society or non-Western countries and the West, which used to be powerful. The G7 used to be the top countries, but they're not the top countries anymore. How do you see any sort of interface there?
I mean, there is an interface in that some of the rightist thinkers would agree very much that this global order was exploitative. They just say that it was exploitative of people in the West as well as exploitative of people in the third world. As far as the changes in power that are happening at present, the figure who's most interested in that is, of course, Dugin, because he was originally a major critic of what appeared at one point to be a unipolar world. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to see the passing of the unipolar world and is now very happy to see the passing of the unipolar world. Quite what he thinks about China has never really been clear. I mean, he's a Russian, he's sitting in Moscow. He's interested in what he calls the Eurasian space, Eurasian tradition, which is not just Russian Orthodoxy, but it's also Islam. And he's been very active in Iran and even more so in Turkey, where he has a certain following there. So the alternative to unipolarity in which he is most interested is the sort of former Soviet space plus Turkey plus Iran. And I've never really seen him do very much in the direction of China.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, in terms of the where the radical right is going, with this whole COVID-19 and the lockdowns and how it's just changing everything, it's hard to make any predictions. But at least before this COVID-19 phenomenon happened, where did you see it going? And now with this change, is there any sort of, I don't know if prediction is the right word, but forecast that you might be able to even make about, because one could say that definitely it was on the rise, the radical right. Do you think it will get stronger, it'll get weaker, that it will now sort of fade away because we have a whole different set of concerns? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that as you seem to think too, it's a bit dangerous to make projections about what the world's going to look like next week, let alone But I actually, in general, things like this COVID crisis, or the First World War, or events like this, tend these moments of break in history. They tend to accelerate things that are happening anyhow. And when I was talking earlier about the First World War, and I said, well, actually, not just the First World War, industrialization and the growth of mass society. I think that, it's likely that COVID will, this COVID period will be a bit like that as well, that it's going to accelerate things that were happening anyhow, rather than set things going in a fundamentally new direction. And of course, I mean, when you're looking at the First World War, it's easy in retrospect to say what were the trends that had started before, which were accelerated by it. And when we try to look at what were the trends of a month ago, you know, it's going to be a bit more difficult. But I mean, I think that the most important trend that was happening anyhow was this reconfiguration of politics around the slow death of the political parties that had dominated for such a long period in the period after the Second World War, and the growth of alternative ideas, alternative parties, and also the growth of identity politics. And I mean, people talk about identity politics sometimes in a slightly dismissive fashion. Now, it's just identity politics. But I think it's completely wrong to dismiss identity politics in that fashion. I think identity is fundamental to politics. And in some ways, one of the things that is happening at present is that groups which were not at the forefront of the development of identity politics have now joined in on this. And now, in gender terms, it was initially about women. And now, in some cases, it's about men. And initially, it was about minorities. And straight white males are beginning to feel a bit of a minority, and they're adopting the same sort of identity politics as other people have been adopting in the past. So I think we're likely to see these trends, and also the anti-global trends, continue.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Well, what would you like your readers to take away with them after reading through your collection?
I think I'd like them to take away the importance of taking the radical right seriously.
Right.
I think also that I would like them to understand that the new politics is not just about the same question that the old politics was about. Now, the old politics was about how should economics be managed? How should the nation be controlled? Things like that. How should the state be controlled? How should the nation be treated in various ways? The radical right is not particularly interested in these questions. The radical right does not think that it's all about economics. The radical right thinks that putting economics, which is a means to an end, turning that into an end in itself, is the wrong approach to things. The radical right is not actually particularly interested in the nation. So it's more interested in other groupings. And the radical right is not particularly interested in the state either. It agrees with the anarchists in some ways, that the state is more of a problem than a solution. So there's a tendency sometimes to see the new politics in terms of old arguments. So, for example, after Brexit, there was a line of discussion which said, it's people from areas that have been left behind by economic progress. And, you know, to some extent, this was true. It was true that the inhabitants of towns which had once lived off mining and which were now in a state of collapse were sufficiently unhappy with everything to vote against the establishment for Brexit. That was true. But to see Brexit purely in terms of economics, in purely in terms of the old politics, without recognizing all these new ideas and these new issues are behind it, is to miss a lot of the point. So that's the other things I'd like people to take away. The way in which the new politics is not the old politics, the way in which the new politics is about new things, not the old things.
Yes, yes. I think that's very important, and I think your book does an excellent job in that. Well, thanks so much for this interview. It's been fascinating and very eye-opening. I encourage all our listeners to not only read this book, but really your, you have a collection of work. Some of your other books are Western Sufism. What's the title of the book on traditionalism?
It's called Against the Modern World.
Right. Yeah. Right. And yes.
It's a little bit out of date now, but it's still an amazing story. And the funny thing about that book is that I had no idea at the time when I wrote it how important some of these thinkers were going to become in the years since I wrote it.
Yeah, I would certainly encourage people to take a look at your work, because you're pursuing a line of inquiry that is important and I think understudied. So thanks again. It's been a real pleasure.
Equally.
That's all for Politics and Polemics this week. If you like this, remember to check out my other podcast, Independent Thought and Freedom, and subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, if you are an academic and want to get heard nationally, check out my free training at becomeapublicintellectual.com. Thanks, and see you next week.